Okay, we are beginning part two of our special series of Shiurim. Again, the general title is Tricks, Loopholes, and Legal Fiction. So last week we took a look at we sort of began with some framework, right? We started off by trying to get down, like I kept saying, sort of the vocabulary and the ideas. What are these legal tricks all about? Are they acceptable? Are they not acceptable? Under what circumstances are they acceptable? And under what circumstances are they less acceptable? Because we looked last week at a few examples, and we saw that sometimes it's okay, and sometimes it's not okay. And sort of the thesis, the hypothesis that we're working with, is that when is it okay to employ a trick? It's okay to employ a trick when the trick comes in preservation of some other halachic value. In other words, when you have one halacha facing another halacha, two halachic values that have kind of equal weight, and the question is, are we able to follow both of them? Are we able to fulfill both of them? Or if not, then that, under those circumstances, when we have those kind of contradictions, when we have that sort of tension, then it might be okay to employ a trick. But just to get out of doing a halacha, so there we're a little bit, the rabbis are a little bit iffier and a little bit less positive about that. Now, this week, what we're going to see is an example of somebody who seemed to cancel a halacha in the Torah. The example of the Prusbul, we're going to talk about what that means soon, is often held up by people who are somewhat familiar with it as an example of Hillel, the Tana, coming in and employing a radical change within halacha, coming up with some institution that essentially cancels something that the Torah says. The Torah says, do X, and Hillel contrived a device that says you don't have to do X. You essentially can cancel a Torah law. The law that we're talking about is the law of the cancellation of debts in the Shemitah year. What does that mean? So it's going to be the first source on the sheet in front of you, but essentially what it means is that the Torah says that during the Shemitah year, during the seventh year, just like you cancel agricultural activity, also any debts are meant to be canceled. If somebody owes money to another person, that debt should be canceled during the Shemitah year. Just in case you're wondering, the technicality is the way it works is that at the end of the year, that's when the debts are canceled. And as opposed to, let's say, Shemitah, the farming component, the agricultural component of it, that goes throughout the entire year. And what happens essentially is at the end of the seventh year, any debts that are owed are essentially canceled.
That's
now,
fair. Hmm?
That is not fair. That's true. Okay, good. So of course, we're going to see that it's not entirely black and white, and there are circumstances in which the debts can still be collected. Right now, here's what it's all about. The Torah says, let's look at the first source. I just gave you five psukim from what is a longer set of psukim, 5 out of 10. It says, Miketz Sheva Hashem Taseh Shemitah, at the end of the seventh year, the English here says, you shall make a release. Now, what does it mean to make a release? So it says, V'zeh Devar HaShemitah, this is what the Shemitah, again, the Shemitah of money, what in Hebrew we call Shemitat Ksafim, the Shemitah of money, is all about. Shamod Kol Baal Mashay Ado Asher Yashab Re'ehu, any creditor who has an outstanding debt from another person should cancel it. Lo Yigoset Re'ehu V'yat Achiv, Ki Kara Shemitah LaHashem. You shall not, sorry, it says you shall not exact it of your neighbor or of your brother, of his neighbor or of his brother. Why? Because karash shmitah l'Hashem, a shmita, a release for Hashem, has been proclaimed. So this is an important line. Shamod kol baal mashe yado asher yasheb re'ehu. Anybody who has a debt, an outstanding debt from another person, should cancel it. You should not try to exact it. You shouldn't try to collect it from the other person because that is Hashem's Shemitah. That's an important line that we're going to have to return to as we go along. Now it continues though. The Torah notes that you're kind of opening up a can of worms here because debts don't only exist between two people who are in business together. It's not only that guy who lent you $5 when you were out for beers together, but debts usually serve a much more important purpose, which is people who don't have money borrow money or purchase merchandise on credit or whatever it is, and they're the ones who have the outstanding debts. And the Torah, so listen to what the Torah says. This is the third pasuk. Ki yeh b'cha evyon me'achad achecha b'achad sharecha b'artzecha asher Hashem elokecha nasan lecha. I see the English doesn't correspond to the Hebrew. Sorry about that. If there's a poor person from one of your brethren who lives within your gates in the land that Hashem your God has given you, lo ta'ameitz levavcha, do not harden your heart, v'lo tikpotz yadcha, and don't tighten your hand me'achicha ha'evyon. And instead, this is the mitzvah. It sounds like it's a mitzvah of tzedakah, but it's more than just the mitzvah of tzedakah. It's not just about giving. We're actually talking about lending here. How do we know? Because if you look at the next pasuk, it says the following: Hishamer lecha, be very careful. Because you might have a wicked thought. This is your base thought in your heart, saying the following: Karva shnat hasheva shnat hamishmita. The seventh year, the year of Shemitah, is coming. V'ra'a incha b'achicha ha'evyon, and your eye will be evil against your needy brother. Meaning, the pasuk says, v'lo titenlo. You're going to start looking at poor people in a way of saying, wait a minute, this guy is a leech, right? If I lend him money now, there's no way that I'm getting it back when the Shemitah year comes. And so the Torah says, well, here we have a problem. We have a potential for people who have money not making loans to people who need money, and the Torah already describes that using all kinds of negative terms. Belial, which essentially means evil. V'ra'ayin cha, you're going to look at him with a wicked eye. V'kara lecha l'Hashem v'yabach ha'chet, that person will call out to you from God and it will be considered a sin. In other words, not lending is essentially considered a sin. But again, what's fascinating is that the Torah recognizes the potential for people to be tempted, at least, not to want to make the loans under the circumstances in which loans are going to be canceled during the seventh year. So the Torah says, instead, naton titenlo, you must give. And don't let your heart be grieved. In other words, don't feel bad when you give. Why? Because God will bless you in everything that you do. So the Torah essentially says this, right? Number one, debts are canceled in the seventh year. Number two is, we understand that might tempt you not to want to lend money to people who are in need during the seventh year. Number three is, that's a bad idea. Please continue to lend money to people who need it, because if you don't, that's considered a sin. Okay, having said that, understanding now that it's a sin, now we have to start talking realistically. At a time that people actually need money, at a time people have money, and if money is a little tight, or if people get too used to their money and they don't want to lend money to other people, it's very nice that the Torah says that it's a sin to not lend it, but as we know, things now are not different than they were 2,000 years ago. Telling somebody that something is wrong is not necessarily a deterrent for that kind of behavior. Saying it's wrong not to lend money to people who actually need it, even if the Torah itself says it, is not necessarily the most successful way to get people to make those loans. So what do we do? Well, that's going to be the answer from the Mishnah. We're going to look at a few Mishnayot from Masechet Shvi'it. Shvi'it means the seventh, and it talks about the seventh year, right? So a lot of it talks about the general standard agricultural seventh year, the Shemitah of the agricultural seventh year, and some of it, when we get into the last chapter of the Mishnah, it talks about, again, this concept of Shmitat Ksafim, the remission of debts during the seventh year. And it probably won't surprise you to hear that after sort of laying out for us that debts are canceled in the seventh year, the Mishnah then proceeds to give us a list of ways that debts are not canceled during the seventh year. Because like we keep seeing, the rabbis are not against figuring out ways around things as long as it's, again, for a good purpose and within an existing halachic framework. And what the Torah and what the Mishnayos, sorry, are going to give us now is essentially appropriate halachic frameworks in which the debts are not canceled. So first of all, the first thing it's going to do is distinguish between different kinds of debts. Because, we're going to start not from the beginning, this is the second source on that first sheet, and I'm not going to start from the very beginning, I'm going to start from the second to last word of the first line. It talks about different people who have to pay fines or penalties to other people. It talks about ha'ones, v'hamafate, v'hamotzi, shemra, people who are penalized by the court for a variety of reasons, a variety of interpersonal infractions, and therefore would have to pay a fine to the other person, to the victim of their infraction. Again, it says here, you know, in the interest of the younger children in the room, we'll just go to the next line, right? These are not considered collectible loans, and therefore they're not canceled. This is a little elaboration on the Mishnah, because for a variety of reasons. In other words, there are certain debts that are not canceled. Don't assume that all debts are canceled. Certain debts are not canceled. Now, this is not an example of a loan. This is an example of a debt, however, money that is owed to another person. Then it says this, V'chol ma'aseh beit din ein mishamtin. Any act of the court, any financial obligation that arises from a court decree, none of those things are canceled during the seventh year. Then it gets, so those are all, again, examples of penalties, fines, etc., that the court imposes. What about loans? What if a person owes money to another person because there was some loan between them? So, the Mishnah is going to give us two examples of loans in which the debt is not canceled. The other. so that's going to require us to get into. So I'm going to. In the interest of time and convenience, and in the interest of not turning this into a very, very long, drawn-out issue, the issue is this. That basically, you know, debts take on different statuses according to halacha. And sometimes the status of a debt after the court passed its verdict already might take on a very similar status to that of a loan, and therefore it's potentially possible that Shemitah would cancel it if it's considered if it has a similar status to a loan. Whereas at certain other points during the process, it would not have the status of a loan, and therefore the Shemitah would not cancel it. But again, to get into that now, that I'm trying to sort of hone in on one point, and I apologize if, you know, there's going to be a lot of things. I'll tell you, parenthetically, like we saw last week, like we're going to see this week, and next week, and the week after, every issue that we touch on opens up a potential can of worms, and we can go off in a lot of different directions, and we could sit on a lot of different points, but I do want to try to keep our eyes on the prize, and all of these points are good questions and valid questions, and every one of them is a discussion in and of itself, and a very valid and significant discussion in and of itself. But again, with your forgiveness now, Jamie, and with the forgiveness of everybody else who will ask these questions as we go along, sometimes I'm going to sort of table the questions and move on. Okay, which is what I want to do. The two examples of loans, we said before, there are two examples of loans at the end of the mission, that's what I underlined for you in the source over here, that are not canceled by Shemitah. What are those two examples? One is Hamal ve'al Hamashkon. This is, if you're looking at the English, the second to last line is one whose loan is secured by collateral, and Bahamoser Shtarotav le'Beitin. One who hands over his loan documents to the court, in that case, the loan is not canceled by Shemitah. Ein Mishamtin, those debts, those loans are not canceled. Okay, so the Torah had said, cancel loans. However, here, the Mishnah seems to be providing us with what sounds like a loophole. Let's first dispense with the first example, Hamal ve'al Hamashkon, if there's collateral. According to halacha, if there's collateral, it's as if the debt has been partially collected at least, and a collected debt doesn't get canceled because it's not an outstanding debt, it's at least a partially collected debt. So therefore, that's not even a loophole or a fiction or anything, that's just simply a technicality of how we understand what collateral is in the relationship between the two people involved in the loan. But what about this last example? Hamoser shtarotav le'beit din. If somebody gives his documents to the court, in other words, instead of being essentially, you know, executing his own debts, he hands everything over to the court and he says, you are now entrusted with collecting all my debts for me, these are yours, and you please do it. In that case, the loan or the debt is not canceled. Why would that be the case? Sorry? Okay, so one possibility is it's as if he's starting to collect it already, which would make it similar to the example of collateral, right, of the mashkon. Fine, that would be one potential example, but that's not how it's seen by most of the commentaries, and we'll see in the Gemara and in the Midrashim also. What they explain is, okay, and this is going to be similar to a case that we saw last week, when you hand your documents over to the court, it's no longer a personal debt.
Exactly.
And if you look at the psukim that describe the cancellation of debts, again, pasuk bet actually didn't give you pasuk gimel, which I probably should have also. It says, "Shamot kol bal mashe yado, asher yashev re'ehu." Every creditor should cancel a debt that he is owed by another person. The Torah talks in terms of debts owed by one person to another person. If I owe money to you, or vice versa, then the debt is canceled. However, if the debt is removed from my possession, so to speak, if it's removed from my authority and it's handed over to the court, then it's no longer me trying to collect the debt from you. Now it's the court trying to collect the debt from you, and that's not the same thing as me as an individual trying to collect the debt from you.
So, if you have a debt, say you loan money, and the person paid you back half of it so that you then already started, then is it forgiven?
So then it's probably not forgiven. Then, but again, like I said, this is again those technicalities that we want to get in, that I want to sort of put aside for a second. But in general, conceptually speaking, what we're saying is, if the debt is paid, if it could be seen as paid, then Shemitah doesn't cancel it. Additionally, if the debt is not being held by the original creditor, then Shemitah also doesn't cancel it. Now, the question is, and we're not going to get into this because this is another one of those technicalities, but just something to think about. To what extent does this parallel the example of the Maser Sheni, the tithe that we looked at last week? If you remember last week, what we saw was, if you get somebody else to tithe on your behalf, then you don't have to pay the 20% additional money, right? So is that what this is? Is this, I can get somebody else to collect on my behalf and then it's not Shemitah anymore? Or is it specifically the court that is allowed to collect and to whom this doesn't apply? Not going to get into that, but in general, it's. I'm just pointing it out because it seems to be a parallel, number one, to what we did last week. But number two, it's the line of thought that the debts have to be personal debts that one person owes to another person, and if the creditor can remove the debt from his own authority, then the debt could be collected. So that's called, again, we're going to call that in Hebrew, Moser Shtarotav LeBeit Din. Literally, that means Moser means to give over, to hand over something. Shtarot are documents. LeBeit Din, the Beit Din, of course, is the court. Okay, that's the first thing that the Mishnah introduces. Now the next Mishnah, this is the last source on that first page, is going to get into the exciting moment, the Pruzbul. The Mishnah continues. Pruzbul eino mishamet. A loan that is secured by a Pruzbul is not cancelled. Okay, now what on earth does that mean? The Mishnah doesn't tell us yet, it just tells us there's something called a Pruzbul, and if there is a Pruzbul, then the debt is not cancelled. Well, what is it? The Mishnah continues. This is one of the things instituted by Hillel the Elder. What happened? Hillel saw that people were not lending money to each other. And they're violating the Torah's commandment that we saw earlier. Etc. The Torah says you have to be careful that you don't have this evil thought and saying, I'm going to not lend money to anybody because the seventh year is coming. And Hillel saw that's exactly what people were doing. They were not only having that thought, but they were acting in that way. People were not lending money to each other when other people were in need. So again, so there seems to be an historical circumstance here that makes it happen. Now, some of the historians will make this even more significant, and I'll tell you that in the time of Hillel, Hillel is living towards the end of the Second Temple period, there was, there was an increase in capitalism within Israel. And an increase in capitalism meant that more people are trying to buy and sell merchandise. Trying to buy and sell merchandise meant that there was a greater demand for credit. In other words, it's not just that people are not wanting to lend to each other and people are being mean and refraining from lending. But it could be that the direction in which the economy was going actually required these loans to happen. And if the loans didn't happen, well, you cancel everybody's credit, then the whole economy is going to start to collapse. So Hillel has the need to make sure that the economy stands and that people actually that continue to extend credit to one another. So what did he do? He instituted this thing called the Pruzbul to make sure that the loans would continue, right? So therefore, the Mishnah concludes, Hitkin Hillel Pruzbul. So Hillel instituted the Pruzbul. Again, he's responding to a crisis. The crisis is people are not lending money. And that means that they're violating what the Torah says, that you must lend money even though the Shemitah year is coming. So to make sure that people would not violate that prohibition, and to make sure that things, that society would continue to run smoothly, Hillel institutes something called a Pruzbul. Okay, so far we just know that there's a thing called a Pruzbul, and that if you have that thing, then your debts are not canceled. Right? By the way, the word Pruzbul, parenthetically, which I really don't want to get into, it seems to have some sort of Greek root to it. The Gemara says that it means sort of something to aid the rich, interestingly enough. The word bull, bet vavlamet, is, if you look, throughout, this word appears a lot in the Talmud, but it also, it's a Greek and Roman word. It tends to mean like, there was something called the bule, which was like the council of elders. So it seems to indicate that they're trying to do something, to institute something that will benefit the wealthy. In other words, the wealthy have to continue to lend, but they're afraid of losing their money, so we do something to help them out to make sure that they'll be able to collect their debts. Okay, having said that, what is this thing called the Pruzbul? That's the first source on the next page. It's the next Mishnah in the series of Mishnayot in Masechet Shviyot. The Mishnah says, Zehu gufo shel Pruzbul. This is the body, this is the text of the Pruzbul. Moser ani lachem ish ploni uploni hadayanim shebimakom ploni. I declare before you, so-and-so the judge of such-and-such a place, that if I have any outstanding debt, I may collect it any time that I wish. And then the Mishnah says, and either the judges or the witnesses sign the bottom of the document. So this is the prosbul. The prosbul is a document which essentially says, I transfer my debts over to you, O judges, and I will be allowed to collect those debts whenever I want. Ploni, I give to you person X, the judges in place. Why? If I have any debt, I can collect it any time that I want. What do you mean? Okay. So the word okay. So again, I'll give you the same disclaimer that I gave you last week, which is we can't always take these English translations too literally. I just pulled them off for the sake of expediency. I pulled them off of whatever I could find half decent English. Some of them I edited, some of them I didn't. But the word limsor, moser, means to transfer. It means to give over. Right. So before we saw moser shtaro tavla beisdin. Somebody transfers his documents to the court. Now he's the word moser. I'm giving. It sounds like he's transferring. Right. Ah, okay. So David asks, "What is going to be actually one of the key questions of this evening, which is, what is or is? Let's forget what is. Let's go here. Is there a difference between this and that? Is there a difference between what we saw in that first Mishnah, the example of the Moser Shtaro Tavla Beitin, somebody who hands all of his documents over to the court and says, you guys are now in charge of taking care of these documents, right? In other words, the authority is handed over to the court and he's not the individual collecting any longer. And this prosbul that Hillel is introducing. That is one of the big, big questions that we're going to be discussing this evening. Yeah, Ben, you had a question?
Yeah. Just a complicated
rule first. Sure.
I understand also when you loan money to somebody, you're not allowed to charge interest.
Okay.
Does the prosbul eliminate that so that you can now charge interest?
No, that's the Heter Iska that was created in the Middle Ages.
After this.
Yeah, this is in the ancient period, and the Heter Iska is created in the medieval period to allow people to collect interest. Heter Iska literally means the business permission. In other words, in the case when people were, the Jews in the Middle Ages sometimes didn't have any professions they were allowed to go into, so they all went into money lending. And when it became their business, then the rabbis devised creative ways to make sure that interest could be collected. And it's not, again, but it's coming from a similar place, right? In other words, we have this similar idea that there seems to be, throughout the Torah, this idea that when we lend money to people, it's always done with some sort of generosity of spirit and good faith. And the generosity and spirit and good faith that the Torah mandates are not necessarily part of the human condition. And the rabbis understand that, and the halacha understands that. And so we try to work with that, and we try to work our way around that, and we try to figure out ways to deal with it. So it's kind of coming from the same place, right? It's coming from the same place in the sense that people who have money and need to do business are afraid of losing their money. So that's what the Heter Iska is about, right? People wanted to lend money, they wanted to get their money back, they wanted to charge interest, but halacha doesn't allow it. And that's what the prosbul is about also. People have money, they're afraid to lend their money out because they're afraid that they're not going to get it back, and so we have to come up with some way of working around it. So, but it's important, what David's question though, like I said, is going to be one of the key questions that we deal with this evening, which is what is the difference between that first Mishnah that says, if somebody gives the documents to the Beit Din, then the debt is enforceable, and this Mishnah in which Hillel goes on about, where the Mishnah elaborates on the prosbul, where apparently the text of the prosbul is, I transfer my debts over to you. Now, there might be one clue to the difference, assuming that there is a difference. Yeah, John? So John notes the clue, right? So what's the clue? Explain.
Well, rather than the court having to go and maintain all of these debts, he's saying, I can collect it whenever I want to.
Okay, good. So one possible distinction, as John picks up from the words, is the difference between saying the court is, who's actually enforcing the debt, right? It would sound like, and one way of interpreting the difference between the two Mishnayos, is that in one case, the debts are handed over completely to the court and they're in charge of the whole thing. They collect it, they enforce it, and they can now then distribute, or not now then, they can then distribute the money to the original creditor. In the second case, it sounds like the creditor has a document that says this debt belongs to the court, but that ultimately the creditor is the one who's collecting the debt, right? And that is one way of interpreting the distinction between the two Mishnayos, we're going to see. The other way of interpreting the two Mishnayos is that there is no difference, and that the Prusbul is just an elaboration on this idea of the Moser Shtar Otav LeBeitin, the person who transfers their debts over to the Beit Din. So we're going to have to see as we go along that question. Are they two different things, or are they the same thing, is going to be key to our understanding of how exactly the Prusbul works. Because if we're going to see that the scope of the two things might be different. In other words, the Moser Shtar Otav LeBeit Din, I remember I said before that the reason that giving your debt, the reason you're giving your contracts to the Beit Din is effective, the reason the court is allowed to collect on your behalf, is because if the court is collecting on your behalf, then you're not the one who's enforcing the debt. If you're not the one enforcing the debt, then we've basically found, you know, this is an example of a loophole, right? That would be a loophole, and it's a loophole that's built into the Torah. The Torah says, if somebody owes money to you, you do not collect the money. Well, if you are not the one collecting the money, then you're good to go. Which makes it sound like, even if we're talking about, you know, it makes it sound like, even according to the Torah, that is a possible loophole. Now, does the same thing apply to Hillel? That we're going to have to see as we go along. Is Hillel talking about a brand new thing? Yeah, Ben, what do you say?
Well, what about if you incorporate and now the business is loaning you the money and you're not?
Okay, so that's an important question that I alluded to before. The question is just, is it not me collecting the debt, or is it specifically the court collecting the debt? And that's something which is discussed. Again, it's too much to go into for the purpose of our discussion, but that is a discussion that's had. In other words, is it about not me, or is it about specifically the Beis Din? Good and important question. I just wanted to, let's just move on a little bit. I just wanted to show you one other important source, which is an allusion to the Prusbul, which appears in another Mishnah, in Masechet Gittin, and it says this. This is the second source on the back of the first page. Hillel tikkun Prusbul b'pnei tikkun ha'olam. Hillel instituted this thing called the Prusbul because of tikkun ha'olam. This is one of the few early sources that contains a reference to that concept of tikkun ha'olam. What does tikkun ha'olam mean? Tikkun ha'olam essentially means making society work. Making sure, again, that the world functions the way that it's supposed to function. So it's not some sort of, you know, this like lofty idea of the world being perfect. It's more a question of making sure that society functions the way it's supposed to function. Again, essentially making sure that the economy doesn't collapse. Okay, so we've now familiarized ourselves with the concept of the person who hands over their debts to the Beit Din, and with the Prusbul, with our big question is, are they the same thing or are they different things? Now, let's get into what the Gemara's discussion here. Because the Gemara has, for the purpose of our discussion, a very fundamental question, which is, again, actually the key question to our discussion this evening. Since our discussion is about loopholes and legal fictions, right? Again, this Prusbul sounds like a legal fiction, and it sounds like Hillel devised this item that allows us to cancel a law from the Torah. The Torah says do X, and Hillel says, well, with my magic piece of paper, you don't have to do X. You can now continue to collect your debts as you wanted to do it. So that's what the Gemara's question. The Gemara is not so thrilled about this. The Gemara says, Hillel tikkun Prusbul, right? Hillel instituted the Prusbul, and it says, Tanan Hatam, we learned elsewhere. Again, it's going to quote the Mishnayos that we just did. The Prusbul does not cause, you know, debts are not canceled if there's a Prusbul. This is one of the things that Hillel instituted when he saw that people were not making those loans. Again, the Gemara here is just quoting those Mishnayot that we just saw, right? So Hillel got up and he made the Prusbul, and the text of the Prusbul is, I hand over all of my debts to you judges who are in place Y, and therefore I can collect my debt whenever I want, and then it's signed, etc. Okay, now, in that third source, we're going to go 1, 2, 3, 4, about four lines in towards the end of the line. The Gemara asks, here's a key question. Umi ika midi demida oraita mashamta shviit the hitkin hillel de lo mashamta. This is, if you're looking at the English, it's the second paragraph in the English in the bottom of the page. Is it possible that where according to the Torah, the seventh year releases all debts, Hillel should ordain that it doesn't release? This is a pretty important question, right? Does Hillel have the ability to make an institution that contradicts what the Torah says? Is this, you know, legal fiction actually a valid item? And the Gemara is going to give two approaches to why it is valid. And we're going to see that those two approaches are kind of picked up by the Rishonim, by the medieval commentaries, in their approaches to the Gemara and to the whole concept of the Prusbul. And they reflect different approaches to this question of, is Hillel allowed to do it? In both cases, the answer is yes. But in one case, and again, we're going to see that this is, seems to become perhaps one of the more dominant approaches, the rabbis, as we kind of saw last week, start to walk it back a little bit. It sounds like Hillel is contradicting the Torah or instituting this prusbul to somehow contravene a Torah law. But listen to what the rabbi says. So the first approach is that of Abaye. The Gemara says, again, we're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines in, about the middle of the line, after the question mark. Amar Abaye. Abaye says, Bishvid bizman hazeh v'rebihi. Hillel only instituted the prusbul for Shemitah in its current state, in accordance with the opinion of Rebbe. What is the opinion of Rebbe? Rebbe is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He was the rabbi who codified the Mishnah. He was the redactor, so to speak. He's credited with committing the Mishnah to writing. And we're going to talk about Rebbe a little bit more when we get to the last section. We talk about other parts of canceling Shemitah. But if you go through the Gemara, Rebbe had an interesting project in which he seemed to have it out for Shemitah. Rebbe seemed to have some agenda of, if not canceling Shemitah, then certainly figuring out ways around Shemitah. Well, why would Rebbe be able to do that? So he has an approach to the whole issue of Shemitah. Rebbe's approach to the issue of Shemitah, without getting into all of the details, is that Shemitah right now in the current world as it stands is not actually from the Torah, it's actually rabbinic. Okay, Rebbe has a whole explanation for that. I don't really want to go into all the details, but essentially, that's Rebbe's approach. Rebbe's approach is that right now, Shemitah only applies according to the rabbis, and that applies both to the agricultural Shemitah and to the remission of debts, Shemitah Ksafim, the Shemitah of money. And because, this is the key line of the Gemara according to Abaye, because Shemitah is only rabbinic, Hillel is allowed to institute this document that says, we're going to kind of work around Shemitah. In other words, Hillel has the force, as the Nasi, as being one of the great rabbis, he has the force to institute a document to kind of work around the rabbinic law. Would he have the same capacity to work around an actual Torah law? According to Abaye, the answer is no. Hillel, the prusbul, only works if we assume that the Torah does not require us to keep Shemitah today. It's only the rabbis who do so. Now, the Gemara asks sort of, you know, incidentally, well, yeah. Right.
So what does he think in the Torah say?
So that's again. So this is one of those examples where I'm not going into all the details. But essentially, what they think the Torah is saying is that the Torah talks about Shemitah and Yovel, right? Yovel was the jubilee every 50 years, right, when all the debts would be canceled again, and all the slaves would go free, and so on and so forth. And the Yovel only applies when essentially, however we define this, the majority of Jews are living in Israel. But after the majority of Jews are no longer living in Israel, the Yovel doesn't apply according to the Torah. What Rebbe says is that Shemitah is dependent upon Yovel. If Yovel applies, then Shemitah applies. So when the Torah says keep Shemitah, it means keep Shemitah when you have to, which is when you're also keeping Yovel. But once there's no more Yovel, then there's no more Shemitah. And the only reason that there is Shemitah now, according to Rebbe, is to sort of maintain Shemitah in the consciousness of the people, so that people set the whole idea of Shemitah won't be lost, but that essentially you don't really have to observe Shemitah, at least not according to the Torah. Which, by the way,
so they don't need this whole loophole then in the first place, then.
Well, no. So once the rabbis say you have to do it, then you need the loophole. In other words, you still need to work around the rabbinic law. You have to work around the mitzvah derabanan.
But if it doesn't apply,
so again, so what's important is that it applies midrabanan. And that's why Hillel's loophole works, or legal fiction, or whatever you want to call it, right? It only works because he's working around the rabbinic law, but he's not working around a Torah law. That's the opinion of Abaye, right? So you still need it, again. But that's it's a very important point, because what it's saying is that these fictions don't necessarily have the power to work around a Torah law, but certain rabbis, we're going to see as we go along in the Gemara, have the ability to work around rabbinic laws. Yeah,
are there any sages that actually associate Yovel and Shemitah, or is it derived?
It's derived, yes, but it's derived because of the psukim that associate them with each other. So we're not going to, you know, when we do the last section, then we're going to get into that a little bit, because the discussion of the Heter Mechira that we're going to do last, which is how to get out of the agricultural aspect of Shemitah, is also very much based on this position. So there we're going to explore it in a little bit more details. For now, I'm just going to sort of postulate that the opinion is out there and work with it. Yeah.
Isn't there also a concept that
current generation of rabbis can't overturn something with prior generation?
We'll get there. We'll get there. So again, but you know, but the question, you know, two things. Number one is we'll get there. Number two, though, is that's exactly the point of what Hillel is doing. In other words, Hillel is not saying, okay, I call it off. And that's exactly why we need the Prusbel. That's exactly, in other words, that's what's so key about the, about these legal fictions, or about the loopholes. Let's say the legal fictions, is that they're not overturning the halacha. Hillel is not saying, listen, you rabbis said we should keep Shemitah because we want to try to remember what it was like when we had Shemitah, but now circumstances are such that keeping Shemitah is not tenable, so therefore I call it off entirely. He's not calling it off entirely. He can't overturn the institution of Shemitah on one hand, but on the other hand, he sees the need to work around it, so therefore, because it's rabbinic, he comes up with a way with a way around it. But again, the way around it is not to overturn it. And that's, again, I mentioned this last week, I'm going to mention it again this week. That's what's so key to virtually every one of these discussions is, and it's key to understanding Hillel also. Again, we're going to see it as we work, as we explore, towards the end of this year, we're going to see this. But Hillel, like I said before, is often held up as sort of this paradigm of the person who figured out how to turn the halachic system on its head. And he's the one who saw that when there's a great social need for change, the rabbis can make the change. But he didn't make the change per se. Again, he didn't cancel any area of halacha. What he did was devise a creative way to deal with it. And that's a very, very key point. Sorry? He didn't come up with that. Okay. So finally, just one last point. Okay, I want to look at the last six words of the Gemara. So that was all Abaye's position. Okay, Abaye, one rabbi, so he takes this approach that the whole thing is founded upon the assumption that Shemitah is rabbinic, and therefore, if Shemitah is rabbinic, then the rabbis have the ability to work around the rabbinic thing. Rava seems to take a completely different approach. Rava Amar, these are the last six words of that passage of Gemara. Rava said, Hefker Beit Din Haya Hefker. That, let's say, Hefker Beit Din means, if the court proclaims property to be ownerless, it is ownerless. Essentially, the English here on your page says, the rabbis have the power to expropriate. It's essentially a form of eminent domain, right, in a sense, right? Well, not domain, but it applies to everything, to all property. The rabbis have the ability, they have the, I shouldn't say the rabbis, the court. However that is constituted, whether it's a real court or a construct of a court, the court has the ability to declare property ownerless. In other words, what's Rava saying? What Rava is saying is, how does the Prusbel work? How does Hillel's idea work? Hillel says we give over to the court, as it were, or we give the individual with this document that says that his debts are now owned by the court, the capacity to collect property, to collect debts. Why does he have the capacity to collect debts? Because the court says so, and the court has the ability to declare who owns what property. The principle of Hefker Beit Din Hefker is like a very, very fundamental principle in the Torah's monetary laws. Because a lot of things, especially rabbinic laws, are rooted in this idea that the court has, again, this sort of eminent domain over essentially all property. And therefore, property can be transferred if the court so desires from one party to another. And so, according to Rava, how does the Prusbel work? How does this document that says, I transfer all of my debts to the court, how does that work? It works because the court has the ability to say, person X, the borrower, no longer owns this money. The creditor, the lender, he owns the money that he originally owned, and therefore he can collect on his debt. So those are two. So what we see here from the Gemara are two very, very different approaches. Abaye is saying, again, that it only works if it's rabbinic, and it can only work with the assumption that Shemitah is rabbinic and it's a way around the rabbinic law. Rava seems to say, when he says this idea of Hefker, Beit Din, Haya Hefker, that any property declared ownerless by the Beit Din becomes ownerless, which gives the Beit Din the capacity to sort of ultimately make all decisions when it comes to debts and when it comes to property. Well, that would work even beyond just a rabbinic Shemitah. That could even work if there's a Torah Shemitah, and that's where Hillel's Prusbel would work, which is kind of daring, right? That is pretty radical. I just want to show you one other rabbinic source. But yeah, John.
It just seems a little bit strange, I guess. If, you know, the Beit Din's overarching goal is to follow Halacha. How Hefker Beit Hefker could allow them to circumvent Shemitah. or whatever the intent of the release of death during Shemitah is. I mean, I guess if it was rabbinic, then they could say, well, obviously the rabbinic reinstitution for support of Shemitah wouldn't have prevented Hefker, 18 Hefker. But for the Torah law, it seems like it would be strange for the Beitin to actually use that as a way to enforce it.
So you're right that it would be strange. And the answer is that Beitin would have to be answering, like the Mishnah sort of outlined for us, the Beitin is sort of answering to another set of circumstances. In other words, they're applying powers that they have, right? The power of Hefker Beitin is a power that the court always has, right? Sorry? It's universal power, exactly. So you're right that they're using it in a way that would seem to circumvent or to contravene even the Torah law. But at the end of the day, it's not outside of the scope of their powers, which is interesting. I just want to show you real quickly. Actually, not so quickly. We have to see this. This is a Sifrei, okay? This is going to start answering David's question, maybe. The Sifrei is a midrash written by the Tanaim. And again, it's going to introduce the idea of the prosbul. And listen to this, okay? It says, we're going to start from... we're going to start from like the fifth word in, sixth word in. Vasher Yelcha. Unfortunately, this is one of the sources which I don't have an English translation. It says, that which you have with your brother, Vasher Yelcha et Achicha, v'lo shel Achicha bi'adecha, and not a debt that belongs to another person that in which you have possession. Mikana ta'omer hamal ve'alamashkon ein mishamet. So if you have a debt with collateral, then the debt is not canceled because it's as though you're holding on to the payment. Next, the Sifrei continues. Et achicha tashmei yadecha, the whatever debts you have from another person will be canceled. V'lo hamoser shtarotav lebeitin, this does not apply to somebody who gives his documents to the court. Now listen to what the Sifrei says. Mikan amru, based on this interpretation of the pasuk, they said, whoever they are, hitkin hilo prusbul mipnei tikkun haolam, based on this idea of giving your documents over to the court, that seems to be the source of Hillel's institution of the Prusbul for the purpose of Tikkun HaOlam, of the preservation of society. Why? And it goes on with that same story. He saw that people were not lending, they were not extending credit to each other, they were violating what the Torah said, so therefore he instituted this thing called the Prusbul, in which you write, I give over my debts over to the Beit Din, etc., etc., etc. Okay? So, it sounds like the Sifrei is saying that transferring all of your debts to the court is identical to the Prusbul, right, that giving them your documents is essentially what's happening, that Hillel might have devised this idea of giving over your documents based on his understanding of the pasuk that says only debts between two individuals are canceled and not debts between an individual and the court. That seems to be what the Sifrei is saying. But of course, it's never so cut and dry. It's never so cut, because we're going to see that sometimes when the rabbinical sources invoke a pasuk, it could either be because they're trying to tell us that this rule is rooted in the Torah itself, or it could just be that they're kind of using the Torah as an inspiration, but it's a rabbinic law, and it's not directly derived from the Torah. Which brings us to our next section, which is what we really need to try to understand, which is, how does a prusbul function? Again, this goes back to the question David asked at the beginning. Is a prusbul an extension of the concept of the Moser, not an extension of, is it identical with the concept of a person who hands over all of his debts to the court, or is it its own thing that's different, right? That's a very, very important question. So, if you look at Rashi, again, I don't want to read all of Rashi inside, we'll just, in the interest of time, Rashi says that the Moser Shtar Tavla Beitin, somebody who transfers all of his debts to the court, that first case mentioned in the Mishnah, that is the Prusbul. In other words, Rashi says, what's the difference between the first case in the Mishnah and the Prusbul? None. The Prusbul is the person who hands all of his documents, the person who hands all of his debts over to the court. Right? Because under those circumstances, once you do that, it's not the individual collecting on the debt anymore, now it's the court collecting. And Rashi says, where does the court get the power to enforce these debts? And he invokes the concept of Hefker Beit Din. Because the court has the power to do what they want, essentially, with the money of, with people's money, with people's property, therefore the court has the right to enforce the prusbul and to say, one person's debts have to be paid, even though, in theory, the Torah seems to say that they don't get paid. That's Rashi's position. So Rashi says, the prusbul and the handing over of debts, they're one and the same. Now, Just want to... The Ramban essentially takes a similar approach to Rashi. So maybe we'll put Ramban aside for a second, although the Ramban does make an interesting point, which is... maybe we'll return to it soon. Maybe we'll get back to it afterwards. So we'll skip over the Ramban in the interest of time. Rambam and other commentaries see things a little differently. They don't see them as identical mechanisms. So listen to what Rambam says. Rambam says, this is again the 1, 2, 3, the fourth or fifth source on that page. The Rambam says, Hamoser shtar tav le beit din. If somebody hands over his debts to the beit din and he says, you collect these debts for me, v'amar lahem atem gavu li chovizeh, please collect this debt on my behalf, then the debt is not canceled. Why? Because the Torah says, asher yelecha et achicha, right, which means that the court is allowed to collect on your behalf. Okay, that's the Rambam in the Laws of Shemitah, chapter 9, halacha 15. The next paragraph of the Rambam now introduces the idea of the principle. So the first, again, in the first one he says, anybody who gives their debts over to the court, the debts are enforceable because it's not you collecting it, it's the court collecting on your behalf. Now, the Rambam continues. Kishara'a Hillel sheniminu umi lahalvot zeh ve'ovrina lakatuv batorah. When Hillel saw that people were not lending money to each other, and they were violating the Torah's dictate, hishamu lecha, etc., be careful that you not have that evil thought that you will not lend to other people. So what did Hillel do? Hitkin pruzbul. He instituted the pruzbul. Kedei shelo yishamein hachobat shilvu zeh tzeh, so that the debt will not be canceled and people will continue to lend money to one another. Now, listen to what the Rambam says. Ve'ein ha-pruzbul mo'il el b'shmitak safim b'zman. But the pruzbul only functions nowadays when the Shemitah is of rabbinic origin. Aval, says Rambam, Shemitah shel Torah, when we're talking about a Torah Shemitah, then ein ha-pruzbul moel ba, the pruzbul is not effective at the time that Shemitah actually applied according to the Torah. It sounds like this. Rashi is associating the pruzbul with the handing over of the documents. He's saying they're one and the same. Hillel's idea was to give your debts to the court and let them enforce your debts. That's Rashi's approach. Rambam seems to say, no, these are actually two different things. A person can hand their debts over to the court completely and utterly. And if they hand their debts over to the court completely and utterly, then the court enforces the debts and Shemitah doesn't cancel them. Why? Because it's not one person collecting from another person, it's the court collecting. However, in addition to that, there's this institution called the pruzbul, which functions, again, that first example, the Moser Shtar Otav, it sounds like functions under any circumstances. If it's Shemitah according to the Torah, if it's Shemitah according to the rabbis, handing over your debts to the court is effective and allows you to continue to collect. On the other hand, there's this institution called the pruzbul, which allows you to collect your debts, and that only functions when Shemitah is rabbinic and not when Shemitah is according to the Torah. And again, this point is made very, very clearly in the next source by Ritva. Ritva is Rav Yom Tov Ashevili. He was a rabbi of Seville in the 13th and 14th centuries. And he says, if you just look at where I underlined, right, he goes to Rashi's position and he doesn't agree with it. He says, Elavada it is certain, Kol Shem Oser Shtar Otav Mamash Lebeitin, Mid Oraita Eina Meshamed. If you hand your debts over to the court, then according to the Torah, their debts are not canceled. Why? The Nagus V'Omein Hu, because it's as though they were collected. But the Hillel tikein pruzbul shelo yehei tzarech lemos lemsor shtar otav. Hillel instituted the pruzbul so that you don't have to give your documents over to the court. You can just go collect on your own. Yes.
Two questions. Why is it problematic to give your documents to the court? Why hesitate if it answer to a higher?
Okay, so this is an interesting question. Why give your documents? Why hesitate to give your documents over to the court? So this is actually a portion of the Ramban that I skipped. Ramban says, here's a little secret for you. The pruzbul is not the only trick to get out of canceling the debts. There are any number of tricks that can get out of canceling the debts, including handing your documents over to the court, including stipulating in the contract at the time that you make the loan that this loan... that we stipulate that the loan will not be canceled when Shemitah comes. You can do that. The Mishnah and the Gemara talk about this. When you make a loan, in fact, the Gemara gets into like the particulars of the exact language that you would use, but it's essentially possible to stipulate at the time of the loan that the loan is conditional on collection even if Shemitah passes. And that's the only condition. And that works. And there are a number of different kind of loopholes. These are all loopholes that could work. And Why not do those, right? So why did Hillel have to come up with, so again, especially according to Ramban, who says that the Moser Shtar Tav is very similar to the Prusbul, why would Hillel have to come up with that mechanism when there are a variety of other mechanisms that could work? And Ramban says something fascinating. He says, ironically, Hillel came up with this mechanism. Why would people, you know, why would people go through this of doing it on their own? He came up with a mechanism so that we wouldn't forget that Shemitah exists. In other words, we sort of honor it in the breach. If we were to come up with any of these other mechanisms, like stipulating in the document that Shemitah won't cancel the debt, then it says, oh, Shemitah never happened. But if I require you to write a Prusbul, then Shemitah's happening. And you have to be conscientious of it. And you have to take the requisite steps to make sure that you are able to collect your debts. Otherwise, Shemitah's going to cancel them. Perhaps, right? Now, why wouldn't you hand it over to the court? It could be a matter of convenience. Again, according to Ramban, handing it to the court and writing the Prusbul are the same thing. According to other people, to Ritva, to Rambam, in which writing it is not the same thing, well, what you're seeing is basically the Hillel is taking the whole concept a step further, right? Handing it over to the court is a very effective way of doing it, but now what we have is actually the capacity for an individual to collect his debts. And that's what's so important. Again, if you look at, according to Rashi and according to Ramban, again, we're still working with this idea of Hefker Beit Din. The court is essentially responsible for enforcing the whole thing. But according to Rambam and according to Ritva and according to that other way that we understood the Mishnayot, the court's not involved here at all. The only role of the court is their name on a piece of paper that's in my hand. Other than that, I'm the one collecting my own debts. So the Moser Shtar Otav, there the Beit Din is fully responsible for collecting the debts. The Prusbul, in that case, I collect the debts on my own. Now, that is, again, kind of tampering with Shemitah in a way that made people uncomfortable. And in fact, if you look at the next source of the Gemara, I don't want to go into all of the... I don't want to read through the whole Gemara because I just want to, again, in the interest of time. But the next Gemara, it's actually a continuation of the Gemara that we looked at before, it kind of introduces this idea that the rabbis are not so comfortable with this institution called the Prusbul. First they start asking, okay, let's be honest here. Hillel's institution of the Prusbul, is that like supposed to be a permanent institution? Are we supposed to keep this forever, right? It asks, L'darehu the Takin, did he institute this for his own generation or for future generations as well? Right? What would be the nafkamina, right? What's the practical difference if he instituted it for his own generation or for future generations? Well, Arnie, this goes to your question before. If he instituted it only for his own generation, then the rabbis have the capacity to say, we abolish it. The rabbis can abolish something that Hillel instituted only for his own generation. But if Hillel instituted this as a permanent institution, a permanent solution to the economical crisis of Shemitah, then the rabbis don't have the capacity to abolish it unless they're greater than Hillel, which, understand, the Gemara does not think any of them are going to be. In fact, the Gemara even says that Shmuel, the Amora Shmuel, who lived several generations after Hillel and was one of the two great rabbis in his own day, he says, this Prusbul is ulbana de daine. He seems to refer to it as some sort of, as a problematic institution, let's say. And he even goes so far as to say, if I had the capacity to do so, I would cancel it entirely. Listen to what he says. I'yasher chayil abatline. I would cancel it entirely. And the Gemara says, really? Did Shmuel really want to cancel the Prusbul, but is Shmuel as great as Hillel? And the Gemara says, that's exactly the point. Shmuel says, I'm clearly inferior to Hillel, so I don't have the capacity to abolish the Prusbul, but if I did, believe me that I would. What's happening here? So the Gemara has a sense that there's something fishy about this institution of Hillel. That there is some, even though we can come up with whatever mechanism we come up with, we could say that Shemitah is only rabbinic, or we could say that Beit Din has the capacity to do whatever the Beis Din has the capacity to do, right? They have this power of eminent domain. Ultimately, what's happening here is that we're using some sort of device, again, some sort of legal fiction, to cancel a Torah law. And so the Gemara is clearly uncomfortable with it. Shmuel is clearly uncomfortable with it. Not everybody shares Shmuel's opinion. Rav Nachman says, ha, Shmuel, actually, if I had the capacity, I would make sure that every debt had a Prusbul attached to it. So not everybody agrees with Shmuel. But the Gemara also walks it back in other ways. The Gemara says, not every court has the ability to institute a Prusbul. It has to be the greatest court of that generation. And that's exactly, the Rambam rules that way as well. He says, only the greatest rabbis could write a Prusbul. They have to be on the level of Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, who have the ability to enforce this concept of Hefker Beitin. But not everybody has the ability to write a Peruzz Bull. So you see from the Gemara, from the Rambam, they're trying to, again, they're trying to walk it back a little bit. They're trying to say, not everybody can do it, and it doesn't seem like it's such a good idea, and Shmuel even says he would abolish it if he could. Because at the end of the day, this does seem to make the rabbis feel somewhat uncomfortable. Ben, is your hand? Yeah.
Do we have a Peruzz Bull today?
We do. Absolutely. Yes. Before next Rosh Hashanah, in fact. That's what we do. Every 7 years, before Rosh Hashanah, before the end of the Shemitah year, right? So next Rosh Hashanah is the end of Shemitah. So it would have to be done before next.
You just can't collect your money back?
Yeah.
Do many people know about this?
So that's an interesting question. The answer is we try to publicize it as much as we can. Having said that, you know, again, based on a lot of the things that we've spoken about tonight, there may be reason to say that even if people don't know about it, that maybe the debts can still be collected. Maybe. It's interesting that, you know, again, this is not for now, but if we... There are a number of approaches to the question of the Peruzz Bull and to the question of whether the debts are canceled or not canceled. In Spanish countries, for like centuries, they didn't bother with the Peruzz Bull. They just assumed that Shemitah didn't apply, that Shemitah was rabbinic, and that it was canceled, essentially, and that, therefore, all debts stand, and there's no need for a Peruzz Bull. In fact, some Ashkenazi rabbis, the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, was a rabbi from Germany who moved to Spain. And he essentially wrote, I moved to Spain, nobody writes a Peruzz Bull, nobody cares, they all have this approach, you know, they work with this assumption that since Shemitah is only rabbinic, that doesn't pertain at all these days, and therefore the debts all stand. The Ashkenazim didn't function that way. The Ashkenazim assumed that despite the fact that Shemitah is rabbinic, debts are still canceled, and therefore if you want to be able to collect your debt at the end of the Shemitah year, you do have to have a Peruzz Bull. Having said that, you know, if it comes up as a practical halachic question, there is what to discuss.
Well, I don't think too many people know about this, and therefore it's not practiced in America as well as in Spain.
I mean, it is practiced in America a lot. There are a lot of people, there are... Okay, there are a lot of people who don't do it, but there are a lot of people who don't do a lot of things.
From what you're saying, two things. One, that when you asked before, was this for just that generation, or did Hillel do this forever? It seems like he did it forever, but it's still coming down to our generation.
Right.
And two, it seems like there's also different opinions with different rabbis of what they want to follow. So getting back to the main question of who can decide what for whom?
Mm-hmm.
Who can make this trick work? In other words, why can't we have rabbis today make the trick work for Tikkun Olam? The use of the iPhone, you know, the use of the cell phone today is gone crazy on Shabbos, and they're coming up with the Shabbos app. So, you know, do you want to see everybody buy that in Shabbos? Let's have a rabbi today say you can only use your phone on Shabbos if you have a Shabbos app.
Okay, so there are two points that are involved, and we'll get to the two points pretty soon. One of which is going to be, you know, in fact, let's to a certain extent, the Tosfot is going to answer, going to begin to answer your question. It's going to take a step in the answering of your question. So, sorry?
He never had a cell phone.
He didn't, but he's going to start, but he did have a Peruzz Bull. So let's figure out what he's saying. So if you look at this is the last source on that page. So the Tosfot says this, right? So it picks up on you know, he says, one second, da-da-da-da. He asks about the Gemara's question. The Gemara, the original question that we said, where the Gemara first says, wait a minute, doesn't the Torah say cancel debts? Where does Hillel get off saying you don't cancel debts? And then the Gemara started coming up with, right, all kinds of things. So, Tosfot says, where does the Gemara come from in that question? Because doesn't the answer of Hefker Beit and Hefker just answer that question straight away? And why would we even ask this question? So look at this underlined section that I gave you. Again, it's the last source on that page. He says, here's the Gemara's problem. This is the Gemara's real problem with Hillel. Delo hayalo lehillel la'akor shviyit shehida oraita, right? Hillel should not have gotten rid of Shemitah, which is a Torah law. Va'afal gav darshina basifrei basher yelcha d'chicha tashmei yadecha. Even though we have that source that says it's possible, right? Even though the loophole is there, listen to what Tosfot says. This is the middle of the bottom line. Mikol makom, in any event, lo hayalo la'asot takana la'meid la'asot kein. It's one thing to have the loophole on the books. It's another thing for Hillel to actually institute it proactively and to say, this is something everybody should be doing. Right? So, Ben, I think this is the beginning of the answer to your question. In other words, there's a difference between the loophole being present and putting it out there. And that's what the Gemara's discomfort with this whole institution came from. Right? And the Gemara kind of has to come up with a reason to explain that it was acceptable. But first of all, it has to go into the mechanism itself to show how the mechanism itself was acceptable, right? Because it sounds like Hillel is saying, let's all keep a loophole. And the Gemara finds that problematic. Okay, so that's, so this Tosfot is making another important point, which is the question of whether we proactively encourage loopholes. Sounds like Hillel is doing it. So is this the exception to the rule? Is this supposed to be the model for everything? Well, first of all, number one, that's one of the big questions that we have to deal with then in terms of, let's say, the question of Hillel's radicalism. Is Hillel a role model for all future generations? Is he showing everybody, look, take halacha and figure out how you can work around it? There are people who say that, right? I gave you the last sort of component of this year is this question, how radical was Hillel? A modern debate. So I gave you two different sources. One of them is from David Gordas in Svara, Journal of Philosophy, Law, and Judaism, which had a whole issue devoted to Shemitah and the Prus Bull. And here, listen to what he writes. He says, though the Prus Bull does not furnish a precedent for wholesale halachic reform, it does indicate that the halacha should be understood not as an ultimate value in itself, but as an instrument for enhancing social welfare and interaction. This is sort of the standard, for lack of a better term, liberal approach to what the Prus Bull is. The standard liberal approach to understanding the Prus Bull is that Hillel saw something that had to happen, and he had the broad shoulders that were broad enough to get up and say, something drastic needs to happen now, I'm going to take those steps, I'm going to make a big change, right? Listen to what it says. Prus Bull testifies to a radical change, which was subject to later efforts to pass off the innovation, is not so radical after all, right? And because the rabbis didn't reject the Prus Bull altogether, so that shows us that radical changes are possible. Like I said, so there is that sort of approach that says, hey, if we can come up with a loophole, if we could change things, if we can, answer the needs of society, then let's do it. That's an approach to what Hillel was doing. I happen to not be under the impression that that's the correct approach. I don't think that that's what Hillel was doing. And I think the whole history of the literature devoted to what the Prus Bull is, how the Prus Bull works. The fact that the rabbis have to try to first see, well, maybe it only applies if Shemitah is rabbinic. Or maybe it's part of the extension of the power of Beit Din. And the line of Tosfot that maybe Hillel should not have really been proactively encouraging the implementation of this loophole. First of all, just first and foremost, what they're saying is, number one, is they're walking back, like I said before, from Hillel's radicalism, from the possibility that Hillel is really advocating changing the halacha in a sort of a broad wholesale way. He's not saying, that there is radical change. No, what he's saying is we work within the system to try to figure out how we can make the system work. That's number one. Number two is we work within the system to see how we can make the system work in times of extreme need. Every source, every rabbinic source that talks about Hillel addresses the fact that it's an extreme need. In other words, people were not lending money. In other words, economically, society was going to collapse if not for the fact that Hillel came along and encouraged the use of the Prus Bull. That's number two. So again, it's the not-so-radical working within the system. Number two, in a time of great social need. Number three is not just working within the system, but it's what I alluded to last week. I want to show you this last source. Last source is from Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi, and he's going to really sort of drive it home for us. Listen to what he says. Keep it emet. Eina takana b'nei dinei shvi'it. Kim b'nogel az harat ha-torah hishem alecha pen yelecha davar m'levavcha b'lial, etc. V'yimneu mila halvot. Listen to this brilliant approach that he has, this brilliant analysis by Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi. He lived mostly in the 19th century. He was sort of a religious historian. What he says is this. If we accept Abaye's position, the Gemara's position, that many, many of the Rishonim accept, that Shemitah nowadays is of rabbinic origin, right? Rambam accepts that. Some people object to the Rambam, but a lot of people seem to accept that nowadays Shemitah is of rabbinic origin. So keeping Shemitah means you're fulfilling a rabbinic mitzvah. On the other hand, the Torah saying, don't refrain from lending money to people when the Shemitah year is coming because that's very evil, that's a terrible thing to do. That's a Torah law. In other words, the Dorot HaRishon, it's an ingenious approach. He says, Hillel had to choose between upholding a Torah law and upholding a rabbinic law. He could keep Shemitah intact an uphold a rabbinic law, or he can make sure that everybody lends money to people in need and uphold a Torah law. And when it comes to a Torah law versus a rabbinic law, who wins? The Torah law, right? That's what the Dor HaRishonim says. Again, it's an ingenious approach. I don't know if it's, you know, you don't see that in a lot of other sources, but it's still a fairly ingenious approach. What he's saying is, when you have to make that choice, and again, this is something that we got into last week, it often comes down to this sort of clash of values. It comes down to this is a value and that is a value. Keeping Shemitah is a value and making sure that people lend money is a value. So it's not a question of radically changing because we see a need for radical change. It's a question of having to choose between two halachic values. Having to choose between the affirmation of Shemitah and the affirmation of essentially tzedakah. And Hillel says, I choose the affirmation of tzedakah while not jettisoning the possibility of Shemitah. Again, while working within the assumption that Shemitah continues to exist and continues to have, whether it's rabbinic or Torah, continues to have some degree of force, and so Hillel has to come up with the prizbul to make sure that Shemitah is still honored, like Ramban said before, while figuring out this tikkun olam, social, making sure society doesn't collapse kind of program. So the example of the prizbul, at least in my opinion, is not an example. Again, if you go through it the way it's been understood by the rabbis over the generations, is A, it's much less radical than people would like to have you believe. B is it's done only in a time of great social need, and C is such an important point. It's done to affirm a Torah value at a time that Torah value has to be, when there's a choice between that Torah value and a different Torah value. And so, yes, in a sense, the prizbul is a legal fiction in the sort of strict sense of the word. But on the other hand, it's a fiction that works within the law, within the halacha, to affirm the halacha, and not to just wholesale make major changes. That is the example of the prizbul. Next week, we're going to look at another one of these legal fictions. We're going to look at the example of selling chametz. And we're going to see, how does that one work? This is one, you know, so Ben, you say, not everybody knows about the prizbul. True. Everybody knows about selling chametz. And almost inevitably, at some point every year, usually the same people will say, oh, so now I sold you my chametz? Ha, 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 ha. So that's a question. How much does that ha, 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 actually belong in the sale of chametz? And how much is a sale of chametz a true, legitimate sale? And why is it okay to sell the chametz in the way that we sell it? That is next week's discussion.